to GalacticConnection.com, one of the most popular blogs on the World Wide Web today for alternative news. Stay tuned for the latest information on our world shift from enslavement to galactic involvement, as well as current intel on any blockages impeding us from our sovereign birthright. Knowledge and self-mastery are key at this time. Our commitment is to present you with the latest breaking conspiratorial articles, off-world messages, exopolitics, cutting-edge technologies and sciences, and also an ever-significant intertwining of spiritual support and metaphysical scope that one needs to dive down the rabbit hole and search for truth with balance. We are truly on the horizon of a new golden age filled with the promise for more love, worldwide peace, and accelerated intuitive skills, where every living being can exist in cohesion and abundance. It is whatever we envision and dream this new world to be. I say to you now, let's redefine the new world to the beginnings of our own precious heaven on Earth. Galactic Connection is here to provide the pulse of Mother Earth through an eclectic range of interviews each Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 4:55 p.m., Pacific Standard Time, Station 2 on BBS Radio, expanding your perspectives on how we can once and for all take back our freedoms, our joy, and our connection with our mighty I Am presence. Our intention remains true to connect hearts and minds everywhere in order to obtain global unity and galactic and universal acceptance. Our discussions will continue to cover anything to do with galactic society and our involvement with our galactic brothers and sisters. Our guests are experts in their fields, and our radio shows have been coined as some of the most thought-provoking out there. In addition to our daily blog, which runs 365 days a year, we also offer a realm of healing services such as our world-renowned implant removal processes, our spiritual past life clearings, our galactic violet ray alchemy from Alexandra, who shares in the lineage of Merlin, and other cutting-edge healing technologies. Check our site out at galacticconnection.com now. Sending you a wave of light, love, and inspiration, and a personal hug and thank you for listening to our Galactic Connection radio show and visiting our blog today. Hey, Kevin, you have surfaced from the hidden corners of the world.
Well, not so hidden, just more off the radar screen. It's kind of a conjuncture of many forces happening right now around the planet, as you know. So we're being kind of wise like a serpent, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. And I've already given a little bit of an introduction on your two new books. But before we review that, I just wanted to know if you could give us a little bit of an update on any of the stirrings that are going on within the Vatican. Apparently, this whole uprise of media attention within the Netherlands and the child sacrificing that's come forth has really created a lot of chaos. Do you agree?
Well, in my books, I compare it to an offshore tsunami, where an underground eruption will cause, you know, an eventual huge tidal wave, and that's in fact what's happening. The seeds we planted years ago when we indicted Pope Benedict, it sent out a massive ripple effect around the planet, and more people are coming forward. I noticed Fiona Barnett in Australia just had a press conference where all the major media are there, even the corporate media show up, and she's describing satanic ritual killings and trafficking in the Australian government. Now, that, just like with the issue of murdered children in Indian schools, that would not have happened a few years ago, and it shows you how this definitely is opening up.
That's fantastic. And, you know, I wanted to ask you your opinion. If someone was to say to you, why are we putting so much focus and emphasis on something so vile and so dark and so, you know, just disgusting, what would your answer be to that?
Well, you can't heal a sick body without opening wounds. And we have to face the fact, which is unacceptable to many people, that for generations, for centuries, millennia even, we've been living alongside a system that is vampiric, that feeds off our energy, and especially feeds off our children. and their innocence and the innocence of Mother Earth. And people are awakening to the fact it's time to end that ancient regime that has been killing our people. And so, you know, it's been exposed from many different fronts, but now it's all coming together. People are developing a common understanding now of the source of all this.
I agree. And, you know, I get a little bit of heat from people that say, oh God, why do you continue to do these interviews on this sort of topic? But I really do feel that this is the seed of innocence and harmony and beauty as our children. And it is pervasive. It affects everyone and everything on the planet. I mean, everywhere.
Yes, and you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this stuff out, or, you know, be anything more than a human being to realize that our first obligation is towards the next generation and the innocent. And that's kind of the theme running through both of my new books, really. I mean, it's just basic.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I loved it when you said that your mental self-image was as a, quote, priest on the side of the poor, untarnished by the greed and hypocrisy of the corporate church. You said that kind of got you through things.
That's how I started out like half my life ago. When I was 30, I was ordained as a United Church minister, and I saw that as my calling for sure. But I had no idea what I was dealing with. I was it pays to be naive and stupid, frankly, Alexander.
I agree.
It takes me into areas a wiser soul would not go, right?
Right.
And I was literally wandering around in this church that had all of this blood on its hands and history of murder and child trafficking in Indian schools. And I just kind of naively kept asking questions like, you know, we say we believe in justice for natives. Well, then I guess we should return the land that we stole from them, not knowing that the corporate interests behind that, you know, that theft were still funding the United Church.
Oh my God. And Kevin, I hope you don't mind, but I just want to share a little bit of an excerpt in your conversation in 1990 with the Pearson United Church. I don't know if you remember this one. It says, you were called into a meeting and they said something that you had to put, you know, when Kevin said he had to put God first, he was being pastorally incompetent. And your conversation, I just cracked up. I really wanted everybody to hear this. It says, well, here's the thing, Reverend. And you said, call me Kevin. He says, oh, okay. It's just that, well, I have a problem with your sermons. And you said, uh-huh. And he says, yeah, you like never tell us what to believe. And you said, is that a problem for you? Well, yeah, I mean, that's why we come to church, I guess, isn't it? You said, to be told what to think? No, well, what I mean is we don't know much about God. But you think I do? Well, don't you? No, not really, just my own take on things. Oh, but you're the minister. Well, that doesn't make me any closer to the truth. So what are you saying, that you got no insights for us? Well, sure I do, but we each have to follow our own conscience and our own sense of faith. Like this past week, I just told our church head office that I wanted to withdraw from the clergy pension plan. You what? Yeah, I didn't feel right storing up treasures on earth when so many people are going without. Oh, yeah, well, I guess I can see that. But still, you're our spiritual leader, ain't you? Shouldn't you, like, be telling us about faith in God and everything? Well, George, I won't try improving on what's already in Scripture. At the end of the day, we each need to work things out for ourselves. I don't know, Reverend, that sounds pretty strange. I had to laugh.
Well,
was this a common occurrence for you?
Well, on many different levels, that kind of attitude for sure, because people have that long tradition, and this is one of our biggest enemies, is that people have been raised to live and think vicariously. That is, you don't think that you have any insights or power in yourself. You're living through other figures, whether that's a teacher, a parent, a political leader, a priest, whoever, right?
Right.
So that's the biggest struggle. The struggle for me has not been facing church and state and, you know, uniting survivors and doing all this. The biggest struggle is to overcome that imprisonment people have in their mind, that they're always looking to something or someone else other than themselves for their own solutions.
Jeez. And that's so accurate for what we're facing today, is that we're really being called to step into listening to our own truth and our own mastery. It is such a key. Now, Kevin, I was blown away. What compelled you to enter the seminary at the ripe old age of 13?
30.
I thought you said something about 13 you entered.
No. When I was 14, I had my first encounter with Native people, like in a real way.
Right.
And I finally went to the seminary when I was 30, after getting a couple of degrees at the University of British Columbia. But the two experiences were very related, because in my book Unrelenting, Between Sodom and Zion, which we're quoting from, I was really shaken inwardly by seeing how Native children in Northern British Columbia were living today. But today, that was 1970. But I mean, it's still, if anything, it's even worse now. Just living in horrible third world conditions, and how that could be going on in the Canada I thought I knew. For me, it was, I understand when people can't accept this evidence right away, because it just jars with their entire sense of who they were and what their country is.
That's amazing. And I was fascinated when you said that. So I think I got it screwed up, because at the age of 14, you arrived on what you called the people's land. And it mm-hmm. was just a little bit away from the Highway of Tears. Can you tell me a little bit about what the Highway of Tears represents?
Well, it's Highway 16 in Northern British Columbia between Prince George and Terrace. And it's where even the mainstream press is acknowledging that countless Native women and children go missing. In fact, the whole Native families just disappear in that area. And it's the same area I went to when I was younger to visit the villages of the Tsimshian people. But and this is in my other book, Murder by Decree, we document how a lot of the missing Native families are being targeted because they are traditionalists. They have traditional ownership of the land and knowledge of the history of the land, and they're being targeted by Chinese and American corporations. You know, they want the water, the hydroelectricity, all the other resources up there.
Unbelievable. And I was just floored at, you know, I've always seen you as a true patriot, but I was really floored when I read that you were the creator of the British Columbia Educational Student Task Force. Can you give us an idea of how that kind of paved the road for you with what you're facing now?
Yeah, well, that was when I was 17 and I was still in high school. Although I never completed high school, I was so involved in politics in that I just didn't see the purpose and kind of an education. I wanted to get out and engage with the world and change it. And that was a burning passion for me ever since I was a teenager. So that to me was more important than a career or anything. The reason I talk about that in the Unrelenting book is that people ask, you know, how did you start in this work and what sustained you? So I wanted to show just personally what are the influences are and how people can carry on if they have a certain background in history already, you know, commitment to working for others and that. So that there was a new government elected when I was 17, the New Democratic Party in British Columbia. They're kind of quasi-left-wing government, and they began to make some changes. This would have been around 1973. And one of the changes is they looked into reform in education, and they hired me and other high school student rights activists under this commission, where we went around the province, and it was really hilarious because it was my first experience of getting attacked publicly. There was a hysterical campaign in the media, really aimed at the government, the new government, but using us as an example of how the NDP government was trying to undermine traditional values and organize high school students for their rights and that kind of thing. So I learned at a young age the power of media contrived hysteria, smear campaigns, getting attacked in the media, like lies, a whole bit that I've faced so much over the last few years with the exposing genocide by these churches.
Amazing. And to learn their tactics at such a young age was quite an eye-opener for me, that you started this at such a young age and you were already on fire to, you know, expose and represent the people. And I mean, I could just feel it in your book. And in fact, I was curious, can you give some of the new listeners an idea of what is a classic divide and conquer method that you've seen throughout this whole entire march for bringing this force to the world?
Well, you know, from that incident when I was 17, it was hilarious because as soon as our group went public, all the high school principals and school trustees got together and formed their own puppet student organization to counter our group. It's called the Vancouver Student Association, and it was totally funded by the school administration. They got all the puppet student council presidents and set them up in opposition to us. So they'd have a TV press conference where, you know, the head of a student council would say, "We don't believe in organizing students. We trust the administration. Kevin's just trying to divide people and get things upset." Very much what, like, the government says now about me and the work I've done about genocide. So it's kind of a very funny deja vu experience. But the system always does that. They divide and conquer the people who they've oppressed and pit them against one another, just like they do very much with Aboriginal people today.
And it is rampant even in the alternative news media community as well. And it, you know, I pretty much say to people, Kevin, that a lot of times if you see somebody going after someone with a great vengeance, you can pretty much bet it's they themselves that are probably guilty.
Right. Well, yeah. I find that so often dealing with the so-called, you know, official Native leadership, because they have from the very beginning been the main force opposed to the uncovering of the genocide of their own people. And they have a huge guilty conscience. The Assembly of First Nations, which is completely government funded, they're the ones opposing the opening up of the grave sites of residential schools. They attack me all the time. They know they personally are complicit in these things. So they distract from their own guilt by pointing fingers at me, and just like any politician does when they're caught with their hand in the cookie jar, right?
Well, and I also noticed that you pointed out that they have mentioned, you know, why is it that it took a white man to bring these exposures to the forefront?
Well, because an Indian who tries to do it gets killed and disappeared very easily. They kill people like me by, you know, defaming us, getting people so afraid that they don't even want to come near me or mention the name Kevin Abbott, because they'll catch a lot of garbage their way. And, you know, it's the character assassination tactics that are as old as mankind, right?
Yes, yes. Well, I'm pretty impressed with the fact that you also, just in your career, I'm going to call it a career with parentheses around it, that you actually, everywhere you went, you seemed to expose corruption and missing money, you know, untraceable funds. At what point did you find yourself saying, there is no difference with, you know, what you were reading in the newspapers versus the actual church that you thought you were going to, you know, join and supposedly gather your flock and try to bring them to a, you know, a higher state of consciousness?
Well, it's a really important question, Alexander, because it comes down to why people continue to cling to a system that they know is corrupt and murderous. They'll agree with you that, you know, about all of that, but as soon as it involves them actually having to pull out, they hesitate. Like, for example, classic cases, one of my aunts in Canada loves my stuff. She reads it. She lives up in Edmonton. She agrees with everything I'm saying, and yet she continues to go to her United Church every Sunday, put money in a collection plate. And it's like she can't relate the bigger crime to her own personal situation. And that's part of that disconnect that we have to overcome.
Yeah. Well, a lot of that's mind control and implants, in my opinion. So now you also really reviewed heavily a very good list of all of the things that you uncovered in the way that, what was it, over 50,000 children have disappeared just in Canada alone, right? Did you say 50,000?
Well, it's actually higher. We did a very thorough kind of analysis of the probable death rates, the number of children in all these Indian schools, and it's more likely over 65,000. But again, this is based on government's figures, which are skewed. They deliberately, for example, one of the things they often did is when children died in the schools, which were literally a daily event, from the beatings, from the exposure to TB and smallpox, you know, not treating children or feeding them regularly, that kind of thing. Whenever a child died, they simply wouldn't report it, because that way, by not reporting it, they continue to get money from the government for that dead child. So you can't trust their own records at all. We had to reconstruct it from partial accounts, testimonies, and that kind of thing. But when you look at a level, a death rate that high, you know, over 50% for half a century, I mean, clearly it's deliberate genocide. And yet still, the media cling to the government's account, which is only about 2 or 3% died, which is absurd. I mean, their own records contradict them.
Unbelievable. Now, are you finding that the tribal nations are more willing to step up and provide more testimony and more information? Are you feeling like that is starting to happen on a grander scale?
No, the Native organizations don't. They're just bought and paid for. They'll never do it. You see individuals coming forward. You know, you see especially the younger generation, Native youth coming forward and literally saying, we feel betrayed. We never knew any of this stuff. Our parents wouldn't tell us what they went through. You get that quite often. And so there's this kind of awakening saying, well, we don't have to blame ourselves anymore. We didn't understand the system that was doing this to us. So it's the old adage that power really, power comes out of knowledge.
Oh my God. Can you share with the audience like the typical types of daily walks that these children have experienced through these Canadian residential schools? Can you just share some of the more prominent ways in which they were treated on a daily basis?
Well, we have a number of accounts of eyewitnesses, people like Harriet Mahoney, Harry Wilson, others who I knew very well for a number of years, and their story is all throughout both of my books. 358 eyewitnesses gave testimony in some way. That whole body of evidence is what we draw on, which is actually the largest single collection of eyewitnesses anywhere by any government publication anywhere in the world when it comes to genocide in Canada. But some of the things they described, for example, they're ripped out of their village by RCMP, police, priests, others who are deputized to do this. Any white person could be deputized to grab Indian kids, bring them into these internment camps. The day they get there, their heads are shaved, they're beaten. There's usually mandatory rape, regardless of the age, beating or mandatory rape to traumatize the children to make them obey. And they're immediately segregated. So if you're a little girl, you will never see your brother again, even though you're in the same building. They're kept in separate dormitories. They're put to work, but basically they were labor camps. They got minimal education, 2 to 3 hours a day. Most of the other time they were put at hard labor, domestic servants, hired out. The principal would get kickbacks for using the children as labor force or as the sex trafficking force. They were regularly farmed out to local child raping networks, never seen again, used experimentally. There were contracts between the military and Big Pharma and all of the churches, Catholic, Protestant churches, for using children in drug testing experiments. This was routine. You know, it goes on, and that's why the death rate was so enormous.
That's just so crazy, Kevin. I mean, I'm looking at some of this stuff. This is truly like Auschwitz kind of experiences. You know, forcing the children to eat regurgitated food, excrement, vomit, and animal remains. I mean, how low can we stoop to do this to children, let alone
it's part of the,
people?
Yeah, it's part of the whole system of traumatizing the nation and grabbing their land and resources and destroying them. You use exactly those kinds of methods. As a matter of fact, we calculated the death rate in the Nazi concentration camps was far lower than in the average Indian residential school. In Auschwitz, it was 15 to 20%. In the residential schools, it was 30 to 50%.
Wow.
And yet, over here, it's not called genocide, right?
Right. Oh, my God. Well, and supposedly, there's not a war going on, right?
Well, that's the thing. You know, that's the issue, that it's not seen as war of extermination. It's called, you know, my Murder by Decree book, I talk about how genocide is concealed. I call the language of normative genocide. And what you use certain words. You don't talk about extermination. You talk about assimilation. You know, you talk about pacifying an enemy, not wiping them out. I mean, it's that kind of language to normalize a crime.
Oh, my God. Now, how, Kevin, does this relate to what's going on within the Vatican? How is it different, or is it?
Well, no, it's no different. It's the same. It's coming from that source in Rome, all of it. The Jesuits established the model for the Indian residential schools in North America. And it goes back to the earlier plan, much earlier in Europe, that the Romans and the Byzantine Empire developed, whereby you, to destroy a culture from within, you grab their children, train them to be agents of the empire, and then use them to rule over their own people. And that was, you know, part of the rationale of how, you know, this led to the residential schools. But it goes back, it's a very old system in Europe, including the whole system of child trafficking, satanic ritual killing. This all has Roman roots, and how it still carries on today very much.
Yeah. And aren't some people estimating, I mean, millions of children actually are going missing and experience this? I mean, millions, Kevin.
Even the United Nations claims that human trafficking involves about 20 million people plus every year. And now, when the official system gives you a number, you've got to increase it many times. It's just a very lucrative system. It isn't a bunch of wacko crazies or perverts on their computer looking at child porn. You know, it's a whole global system backed by big money. And, you know, we found that when we began to surface the Ninth Circle satanic killings in Europe, and how that was tied very much to the European mafia, the Vatican, and those kind of groups.
Now, I've noticed you've not returned to Europe. Are you just pretty much being advised to stay out at this time? It's too dangerous for you?
Not necessarily, no. I've just had a lot to do in North America right now in terms of getting these two books out, and just really being amused by how there's in all the work I do, the government of Canada immediately responds. But they don't make it seem like they're responding to what I'm doing. They delay a little bit, but then it's definitely in response to the publishing of this that the Canadian government recently announced that they had just received permission from an Ontario court to destroy all of the evidence related to residential schools. So in other words, a court in Canada gives the government the right to destroy evidence from a crime scene. I mean, you know, in law school, I learned that was a no-no, to tamper with crime scene evidence. But now they can legally destroy it all. Anything in their possession, because their backs are to the wall, they're panicking, and they realize now that we're publishing the truth, they've got to get rid of anything that's left.
Unbelievable. And let's hope that somebody within that destruction of records has a conscience.
Well, there's always people like that in the system. That's how I was able to get so much information, not only about the crime, but the cover-up and what they were doing to undercut the few of us who were campaigning around all this. So, you know, like, you know, that's what I describe in the book Unrelenting, which is really a companion piece to Murder by Decree. It tells how it happened, how this whole, you know, epic struggle really came out over 25 years.
Again, you know, for anybody who hasn't checked out his book, Unrelenting Between Sodom and Zion, it really fills in a lot of blanks, even for me, because I've interviewed Kevin quite a few times. And one of the things that I was able to really do was connect the dots on your life and how it is so obvious that you were born to do this. You know, I mean, it was just blatantly obvious once I read through your book. You know, I was also wondering, the United States, we talked about this a long time ago. Is there any more evidence coming out regarding the you know, destruction and removal of children within the USA?
Oh, yeah. You know, as a matter of fact, I'm in America right now, and one of the things that has come to me from different people is that the Indian boarding school system in America wasn't as blatant and as extensive as in Canada. It was just as severe. The Jesuit-run Indian schools in South Dakota, they were churning out corpses there constantly. As a matter of fact, I've spoken to a number of people who helped bury children there. They even saw a baby buried live beneath the floorboards of the school by a Jesuit priest in 1971, getting rid of the evidence, right, like they did in Canada all the time. But what I'm finding, though, is that in the research about child trafficking today, there's certain hotspots, like the Gila Indian Reservation in Arizona, where children disappear all the time. It's got the highest rate of children disappearing of anywhere in North America. And these Indian reserves are being used today by predators. And these are, like, again, backed by big money, satanic ritual abuse networks, but also the global child trafficking network preys on a lot of Aboriginal children and other children in orphanages and the foster care system.
Unbelievable. Now, what is the reasoning behind the focus on the Aboriginal children?
Well, there's different levels to that. Spiritually, of course, you've got to destroy Indigenous people, like real Indigenous people who still have a tie to the land, to the power of nature, to the forces, you could say, in the universe that operated once through all of us when we're tied to the land and its language and its spirit. And there's obviously a move to eradicate all Indigenous people. So that in itself makes them a big target of the corporate machine. They also, when they sit on valuable lands and resources, like Canadian and American Indians still do, they're targeted by big corporations, like especially the uranium industry, who are destroying the Lakota and the Black Hills in South Dakota. Cameco, it's the same uranium company doing it to the Cree in northern Saskatchewan to provide depleted uranium to the U.S. war machine. You know, so they have that being that double targeting for that reason. But finally, I think it's also, it's a strange thing about a culture when you destroy another. On the one hand, you feel guilty about it, but you display that guilt through a sentimentalizing of the very people you're destroying so that they're abstract and distant and you never can never relate to what's happening to them. So, you know, you see this in Canada a lot. You know, they have a sentimental attitude of Indians. And when a lot of people are, white people are in one of my meetings, and a native person walks in the room, everyone gives them kind of paternalistic smiles, almost to say, don't get too close to me, but I'm going to pat you on the head a bit. The British did the same thing when they conquered the Scots in the Highlands. The British aristocracy developed this thing called a kilt, which was not a traditional kilt at all, but it became fashionable among the British aristocrats to dress like the Scots. You know, like a lot of white folks want to go native now. It's that same kind of symptom of the legacy of genocide, where they're never allowed to become human beings in our minds. They're just these images, right?
Incredible. Wow. And do you also feel that with all of the testimonials that you've brought forth and all of the exposure, and I know that that huge project that you worked on at Mushall, where you were able to find the bone that was, definitely human. I mean, do you feel that bringing forth this evidence has even gotten this satanic establishment to even blink an eye? I mean, do you feel that they are feeling the pinch from what you're doing?
We know they are, and it isn't just because of the work I'm doing here in North America. But what we started going in Europe with the Common Law Court of Justice and the ability of that court to actually not only indict and convict, Ratzinger, the present Pope Bergoglio, and others for these crimes, but actually set up teams that went around and started trying to hunt where these child trafficking things were and child sacrificial rituals were happening. But no, definitely it's had an enormous impact, but it's like an iceberg. You don't see a lot of it. They are sitting up and taking notice. We know that. And we definitely have saved lives because of this work.
That's fantastic to hear, because in such a very deep, dark conversation as this, you know, I mean, it's good to see some silver lining coming out of all of it. Now, you mentioned too that one of the other major kind of sins against the Aboriginals was actually the white people themselves. I loved it when you were talking about everything from Bibles, smallpox, guns, and rape were, basically spread throughout the Aboriginal and tribal nations. Do you feel that that's still essentially going on today? I mean, I know that smallpox is not like rampant, but I also, at the same time, very aware that there are viruses being sprayed in the chemtrails.
Yes, well, you know, the classic example of that was during the whole swine flu snafu. The Tamiflu drug was tested out among Native Indians all over Canada first. Because under the Indian Act, if you live on the reservation, you cannot refuse medical treatment. It's a crime to say, no, you cannot shove a needle into my child's arm. So they were forcing this drug on Indians to test it out. So that drug testing still goes on all the time because Indians aren't citizens under the law in Canada. They're wards of the state. They're dependencies. They're not citizens or human beings. That's an old papal idea going back 1,000 years, that if you're not a Catholic or you're not a, quote, civilized person, you don't have any rights. You don't have any status. So, I mean, what you mentioned about Bibles and smallpox is very important because it's part in the book where I describe a story called about the two-headed snake who comes and devours the people. And by the people, I mean, you know, native people. And one head is very loving and smiling. The other is vicious. And the shaman says, this is a crazy creature. You can't trust him because one head is saying one thing, one head is saying another. You have to just shun this creature and have nothing to do with him. Well, of course, that creature is us, is our so-called white culture, because we are so dissociated. We don't understand who and what we are. We don't understand that the very people who are, you know, saying we want healing, we want reconciliation, are also the ones who turn around and rape and destroy the children. And that's because, you know, somebody told me the other day, there was a Catholic priest who was being interviewed, and he said he was retired, and he said, oh yeah, well, I molested boy. Yeah, sure, everybody is doing it. Everyone is expected to do it.
Wow.
And it's a commonplace thing. You know, there's policies protecting them to do that. It's an official Vatican policy that you child rapists in their ranks are to be protected, and the police never told. But that criminal policy can only happen because it's an accepted fact. It said children are not human. We can do whatever we want to them, but we also love them. I mean, it's that sick, you know, dichotomy that until we look at that sickness and deal with it, the crime's always going to carry on.
Oh my God. That's crazy that he actually just admitted it, you know, very arrogantly, you know. Now you talked a lot about the plague, which I'd like you to kind of expound upon that, because I thought that was fascinating.
Well, that's really part of what I'm talking about is what I just said. The plague is that it struck my people in Europe centuries before we came here. What it did was, by ripping us off the land and making us subordinate to really a regime of fear, you know, run by out of Rome, which said you cannot think your own thoughts, you cannot be your own self, you've got to be what we tell you to be, and you've got to serve our really corporate system, because the Church of Rome was the first corporation on the planet, because it came out of the Roman Empire, and all things are to serve it. Now, one of the things I do in my book, Unrelenting, is I describe some of my ancestors, and one of them, of course, was Peter Abbott in England in the mid-18th century, who got locked away in prison and in the public stocks for simply criticizing the Church of England and questioning, using reason, whether the Bible could be really accurate. And that locked him away because he was saying to people, you can't believe the lies the church and the government tell you, because they're one and the same, and it's how they rule over you. And, you know, that's a direct challenge to the power. So I often kind of joke that, well, I guess it's kind of obvious that if I'm not his reincarnation, it's certainly influencing me in a big way.
I bet. Yeah, I remember reading that part. You have quite the lineage, huh, Kevin?
It helps you.
Yeah, big time. It's like patriots all the way through.
Now, well, not all of them. I mean, but you know, enough of it in our bloodstream to keep it going, put it that way.
Yeah, I think so. I definitely think so. You know, one thing that came to my mind was, how many of those who have gone through seminary training are actually expelled for denouncing what they see with the corruption within the church? I'm just curious if you've researched that.
Well, not a lot. I mean, there are, I once read there's a group called Ministers Mutual Aid. They provided, you know, therapy and counseling for ministers who had left the church. They estimate that both Catholic and Protestant clergy, about a third of them, are forced out of the church unlawfully. Are victimized in some way. So it's really an enormous number, but the church is a culture of silence. You're never supposed to disclose anything. And so most of these clergy just fold up and die and go away somewhere and retrain and never want to talk about it again. But the ex-clergy I've spoken to, it's like talking to whistleblowers. they have learned to live very individualistically and trust no one. And so most of them don't even want to talk about it because they figure they're going to get re-victimized. But frankly, even, you know, beyond all that, the attitude in the seminary is it's a form of brainwashing in a big way, pumping people up to make them feel that there's some kind of special group, and then letting them know that you're not to disclose the company secrets. Classic example of that was at the Vancouver School of Theology where I was trained, and which I talk a little bit about in the book I'm relating. Just a couple of years ago, a friend of mine was speaking there, and he said to a young girl who was just beginning to go through seminary, my name came up, and she immediately said, well, he can't be trusted.
Wow.
Well, I mean, why would somebody who I'd never met say that unless the whole smear campaign was not only so effective that it creates this idea that, well, he went against the rule, the unwritten rule that, like they say in the Catholic Church, it's not a crime to rape a child, it's a sin. The crime is to talk about it, right? Mm. And it's that law of silence. And I guess it's true, I can't be trusted to keep that silence going, because anyone with a conscience has to one day realize that you have to go up against that system of lies.
Well, Kevin, considering you've been, expelled for all sorts of different things, trying to expose various corrupt activities, but also I just cracked up when you were going to try to withdraw from the pension plan. It's as if they knew ahead of time, they had their eye on you from a very early age,
Well, they're pretty inept if they did, because the job I had just before coming to Port Alberni, where this whole residential school thing got blown open, I worked in Fred Victor Mission in Toronto, which is the largest United Church street mission. And there I uncovered from people on the street, from people on staff who were bringing me the evidence, they were laundering money, and they still do this. The United Church launders money through there. They are involved in drug trafficking, prostitution, all of this corruption. And we took that to the police, and they refused to investigate and even threatened us if we looked further into it. And once I had done that, I'm thinking, why in God's name did they allow me to go off to where the Indian residential school crimes had happened? They knew I was a person of conscience. I wasn't going to show up. Why the hell would they put me there? A big corporation often doesn't know what the left hand doesn't know what the right is doing. But I also have a theory about that it's institutions that are doing crime have a secret death wish. They want the truth to come out, but they're all incapable of bringing that out themselves. They rely on people to do that for them almost.
That's crazy. And, one of the quotes in your book was somebody was harassing you and they said, knock off all this social justice crap. Stick to being a pastor. And you really brought to light the expectation of the church in what you are supposed to talk about when you're, on the pulpit.
Right. Well, the local folks in the congregation, they tend to be a lot more kind of, redneck. And that was a local official talking to me. But within the higher church, the United Church loves to present itself as really a with it progressive church. They believe in ordaining gays. They're opposed to genocide in other parts of the world. They had a big campaign to support the Guatemalan Indians who were being attacked by the military there. And yet the very same United Church is killing off their own Indians in Canada. So there's acceptable social justice issues and there are others that aren't. And, corporate inside maneuvers to grab Indian land is not one of the issues that any church likes to have exposed.
That's just crazy. And for anyone who questions Kevin's commitment, he pretty much lost everything because his conscience was screaming that he had to pursue the truth and bring justice to this whole cause. As for example, how long has it been, or how long was it before you were able to reunite with your children? Because they were ripped away from you.
Yeah, when I got fired by the United Church, literally the next day, They came to both me and my wife separately. Like, I didn't know they'd gone to my wife at the time till much later when it came out in divorce court. And they said to me, you've got to agree to psychiatric evaluation and retraining without pay for a year.
Oh my God.
Or you're thrown out of the church.
Wow.
They went to Anne. They went to my ex-wife and said, we're never going to hire him again. We're going to make sure he never works anywhere in the country again. If you want to leave him, we'll help you pay for your divorce and help you get resettled. And as a matter of fact, the church spent over $60,000 on her divorce of me to make sure that my kids would be taken from me. So when you're trying to slam dunk somebody like that, that fact alone is proving everything I'm saying. I'm not just some guy they didn't like. I was to be slam dunked because of what I was bringing out. And so their own actions expose them, what they're doing.
Yeah. And your children, they were what, 4 and 7 when you last saw them?
My girls were 6 and 3 when this happened, and they got taken from me. And I got to see them twice a week for 4 hours at a time. I was criminalized, and it estranged us naturally. I did everything impossible to maintain contact, and the times we had together were wonderful. But just a few years ago, my eldest daughter, Claire, said to me, you know, Dad, I get funny feelings when I'm around you longer than a few days. And I said, of course, sweetie, because you were raised in a very strange environment where your mom was constantly telling you kind of indirectly or directly that there's something wrong with Daddy. You know, he's in trouble with the church. And, you know, she even would threaten them with denying them dinner if I got them home later than 10 minutes after the appointed hour. So, I mean, all that incredible stress on children, it has a long-term impact. And while they love and admire me, they do so from a distance, just like most other Canadians do. And it's one of the impacts that any whistleblower has. You pay it this enormous personal cost that at the time you couldn't have imagined you were going to pay.
Unbelievable, Kevin. What do you feel has kept you going?
I knew you were going to ask me that. A whole number of things, but it's a part of me that I didn't realize was there until I was under duress and it came out. My ancestors, the very fact that facing these crimes every day, I realized my conscience didn't allow me to step back. It really was that simple.
That's fantastic. So an uncorruptible man you are.
Well, I don't want to put myself on a pedestal. I mean,
you on a pedestal. That's just stating a fact.
Yeah, I mean, I've gained strength and I think even more integrity by having to go through this because like anybody at the time, I was tempted. I mean, if the church had have sat down with me and made me an offer, of course, like any husband and father, I would be thinking first, how do I protect my kids? How do I continue to provide for my family in that? And yet the fact that I didn't, meant there was another aspect of me that I wasn't aware of. And it's the thing that goes beyond love of family and love of your children. There's something more basic, and that is the love of truth and being able to look at yourself in the mirror and look at your own children in the eye one day and say, you know, we can't prostitute our own souls for anyone or anything, which is what the system always does to us. You got to choose between the truth and your children or your job or whatever. Well, to hell with that. I refused to make that choice. And I said, you know, what about all those children in the ground? And they're still going to die tomorrow if we don't take a stand.
That's a very good point. And the energies are as such where it is truly lifting people into their appropriate walks and missions regarding whistleblowing in whatever sector of society, because our society is sick. Just like you said, it's a plague that goes all the way back to the Roman source. I loved it when you said that. And then you travel to Ireland, for example, and you see the same thing all over again.
You sure do. And that was quite, you know, going to Ireland was part of the whole process that led to the development of the tribunal and the common law courts of justice. And it's even more blatant over in Ireland. I mean, there's that long history. I mean, I say to people, yeah, the United Church did these crimes. They've only been around 100 years. The Roman Church has been doing this for 2000 and even earlier than that. So, I mean, you see that corruption, and it's so widespread and deep-seated in Europe. I mean, it's mind-boggling. You know, in Italy, a judge can't even make a decision in a case involving the Catholic Church without talking to the local bishop first. They have to, under the law, consult the bishop.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
That's crazy. Yeah. It really goes to show you how even those that we are not respecting are also prisoners within the system.
Say again, sorry.
Well, those that we are not respecting for their own activities and their own assistance to this disgusting, genocide, I should say, even they themselves are prisoners.
Oh, well, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's one of the horrible ironies of this whole thing, that it's like, you know, when you're talking to a veteran, there's no one who hates war more than somebody who's been through it, but they're not going to come out and denounce it because they've got so much of a vested interest in it. It's like, well, you know, like talking to, and I had experience with this when they were throwing me out of the church, talking to these people who were doing it to me, trying to appeal to their humanity and reason and realizing it wasn't there. Because of the higher you go in a corporate structure, the more the winners are those who can eradicate their own conscience and be functional psychopaths. And those are the ones you're dealing with. So to appeal to the system for justice is absurd. It doesn't operate according to humanity, but corporate efficiency. And you've got to threaten their public image and their money. That's the only thing that the system understands. And that's how we got change, by threatening the money and the public image of these churches.
You know, and as David Icke said, this whole entire matrix is run by psychopaths who don't have a sense of freedom and justice. It's not even in their vocabulary. So why would we seek them out to bring forth that which we want, you know?
Well, exactly. And the question, of course, is not the minority of psychopaths. It's why do the majority of so-called normal people hand over their authority and power? And until we understand and change that, there's no hope in this situation, because they are there in power because we allow them to be, and we give them the taxes and we give them the attention, you know?
Yes. You know, I remember reading in that one, God, there was a gentleman, what was his name? Don Epperson. He was,
yeah.
And he said something like, action is the measure of all things. I love that line. I just like.
One of my mentors.
Yeah, that's where we're at today. Now, the International Common Law Court of Justice, what was the deciding factor for you to launch that?
Well, that was a very much a group effort. After I went to Europe and to Ireland in 2010, I was encountering people over there, ex-judges, some lawyers, human rights people on the ground, who for years had been trying to prosecute the Catholic Church, and they had been trying to do it, like I did for a while, through the existing courts. And that was a complete dead end. And so they realized they needed, like after World War II, they needed a new body of law to put whole systems on trial for genocide, because under the existing laws of the United Nations, and that you can only try individuals for genocide. And of course, the problem isn't individuals, it's whole systems of thought and corporate operation.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
So they helped convene that court as well as me.
So are you able to talk about how many people are participating in that law court, the common law court?
Well, these courts were convened to try two cases, and they don't continue after that. Like any court, they're called into existence around specific cases, and then the case is done and so on. But the first case had to do with genocide in Canada. That's the one that forced Pope Benedict to resign February 2013. The second one involved a global child trafficking, where the present Pope and others, some of whom also stepped down after they were indicted, by the court. These various defendants were named as participants in a child trafficking and sacrificial network, largely based in Europe, but also over here. The significant thing about these cases is the response it engendered, and how really simple it was to do. You know, you put out a call for citizen jurors, you subpoena the defendants, you present the case and the evidence. That's pretty much what we did. But in the second case, unlike the first, we weren't able to publish so much of the court documents because it's an ongoing investigation, you know, that's kind of open-ended involving the Ninth Circle and these other sacrificial cults.
That's awesome, Kevin. Thank you so much for just, because I know you lived a really difficult life back then. And even now I know it's pretty stressful. We've had enough conversations off radio shows to see with my own two eyes the kind of stuff that you put up with just to get the word out on this. And there was a period of time, wasn't there, where you were basically homeless? You had no car. You had very little money to even survive.
Oh, well, that stuff doesn't stop. There was a period of time where I was homeless when I had a car. I'm not allowed to renew my driver's license in Canada. There's a do not renew sticker on my thing. You know, they hit you from all these directions. But what I found was even when I was homeless and penniless, all sorts of support would come to me at the right moment. You know, when I had to travel to Europe, somebody would donate $2,000. And, you know, I mean, that kind of thing would happen. So I saw the hidden hand in a lot of this work, you know, from early on.
And that is so crucial for all of us who are really trying to get this kind of information out there, because we don't make the kind of money that the corporations do we, Kevin? They block us every step of the way.
It's not really even about money, because, I mean, for example, when we produced our first documentary film, Unrepentant, just three of us on Vancouver Island did that film, and it cost us maybe $1,500. We stick it up on the internet. 500,000 people have seen it within 2 months, including a member of parliament who gets up in the House of Commons and asks when Native children are going to be returned for a proper burial. I mean, that's what triggered the whole so-called apology, the government cover-up. You know, just being there at the right moment, you know, with the right ammunition, and you can move mountains. And so that's really, it's not a matter of money. It's about determination.
And taking action.
Yeah.
Taking action.
Exactly. Not just talking, not just documenting. We occupied churches, and it very much upset them. You know, you hit what they hold as sacred. It's like Sun Tzu says, a small opponent can overwhelm a larger army by attacking what they hold dear. Then the larger army has to respond in the terms of the smaller. Right? That's exactly what we did.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty profound. Now, question. You and I've talked a couple of times about your exorcisms at St. Peter's Square. And I know you've performed at least two. Can you talk to us a little bit about the repercussions of those exorcisms upon the Vatican?
Well, the major one happened in October 2009, and it happened quite spontaneously, actually. I went over there. I was invited by some Italian human rights groups, and I brought with me some soil from a mass grave site at a Catholic Indian school, and I thought it was only appropriate that, you know, the remains from there be brought symbolically back to the source of the one who had caused this, their mass murder.
Wow.
And I was there at St. Peter's Square, and if anyone who goes there, you know, it's the most heavily monitored place in the world. Vatican security, closed-circuit cameras, Rome police, constantly monitoring the place, which tells you something right there. But I stand there in the middle of St. Peter's Square, which is not Italian territory, it's Vatican territory, okay? I'm standing there in my regalia, which is obviously not a Catholic priest. And, you know, I take out the stuff and I'm doing a ceremony. And right away I realize, okay, something came to me. This is really an exorcism. You're calling a spirit of lies and murder to leave, to depart, which is like stage one in an exorcism. You force the entity to name itself. And I'm doing that. And these cops are walking by and ignoring me. And normally if you do anything there, anything resembling a protest or anything, you grab immediately. They left me totally alone, which was unexplainable, first of all. But then the next day, a tornado hits the center of Rome. And a bigger tornado hits the European media, because that very same week, the first story surfaced about Ratzinger's role in covering up child trafficking in his own church. And talking about forcing an entity to name itself, everything fell apart after that. That was kind of, we kicked the door in there spiritually, if you like. And I didn't know that was going to happen. I was just kind of the eye of the storm, but these things come to us. I mean, it's not like I planned all of this stuff. You're taking steps And it happens as you go if you keep acting the right spirit.
I agree. And just with some of my planetary mission work, the message comes in, you have a hunch, you follow your intuition, you follow your spiritual guidance, and you basically are just going with it. You know, it's not like a pre-planned, gee, I think I'm going to do this in 2007, and I'm going to do this in 2010.
No.
You know, you're kind of like on the hook, on the phone, waiting for the call. You know, that's how I talk to people. Well, so how about the second exorcism?
Well, that was, stage two, if you like, happened. I'm trying to remember here, getting dates. I'm just recovered from an asthma attack, so you might hear it in my voice. But
I noticed.
Sorry, the quality is a bit less because of that, but...
No, it's fine.
Okay, good. I'm coming in clear in a minute, am I?
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay, so it happened in 2012. It was a follow-up action in Rome. And the second stage of an exorcism is normally you're calling the entity to depart. And it's very interesting because it was right at the same time that Bergoglio came in, that present so-called Pope Francis. And his entire effort has been to try to make it seem like the Vatican is all better now. And in fact, what's happened, and I know you asked this earlier in the interview about the state of things in Rome. I mean, you've seen basically a complete collapse of the whole traditional system in the Vatican, whereby they are situating themselves geopolitically to be allied with the BRICS nations. They're leaving the fold and of, you know, the traditional alignment with the Western powers. And it means a big shakeup. There's a big faction fight going on between those around Ratzinger, who's still hiding out in the Vatican, and around Bergoglio. Bergoglio is a hand puppet. Everyone's to watch him and not see what's going on. And all of that is, I mean, definitely coming out of the spiritual shakeup going on, whereby we're saying, look, everyone knows you're a criminal syndicate now. Under international law, you have no right to operate. So its mask has fallen, and it's doing what any defeated enemy does, which is trying to distract and engage in a rearguard action so you can't see its retreat. And that's very much what I think is going on at that level.
That's incredible. So their alignment with BRICS, has it become obvious from the standpoint of, you know, prior conversations where we discussed the movement of the money from the Vatican Bank, you know, that kind of thing? Do you see any correlation there?
Very much. I mean, that's being talked about a number of different sources. People who know economics better than I do, but they're talking about massive money transfers out of the Vatican Bank into the BRICS banks. People have different interpretations of what the BRICS alignment is. I don't want to talk about that, but what I do know is going on is that they're in a financial crisis, and because a lot of the loans are being called in. The Vatican Bank itself is in major debt to Asian sources, which nobody wants to talk about. The Arab and Asian world, just like in Canada and in America, most of the U.S. debt is, about half the debt now is owned by China.
Yeah.
They're buying it up.
Yeah.
They're buying up all the resources in northern Canada. As a matter of fact, as I talk about in Murder by Decree, the disappearances of Native people are now being engineered by the Chinese corporations there. They want the resources. They're eliminating the natives on the land, just like the way the English settlers used to do. So, you know, the focus geopolitically is shifting to Asia, definitely, to China. And that's reflected within the Vatican itself.
God, that's crazy. And, you know, I think what everybody just kind of sits back and wonders is, you know, we tend to look at Asia and China right now as kind of the saving grace for the planet, because we're seeing a lot of positive things coming out of that part of the world. And what, you know, someone had reminded me to remember is that China has rarely gone out on a military operation like the United States does all day long, every day. You know, they've basically been kind of staying to themselves, but that they fight the so-called war through the financial arena. They know exactly how to...
Right.
impact you know, the United States and other countries. And in some ways, Kevin, it's being looked upon very positively that they're finally affecting the cabal and, you know, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, and which ultimately will impact the Vatican. Where do you see the Illuminati fitting into this whole thing? Like, I mean, they're saying that there's two actual Illuminati factions. There's the one that's been hidden, like the hidden hand, that is behind a lot of the releases of information that we've not been hearing until recently.
A lot of that is speculative. I've never seen much hard evidence about it, but, you know, people have different ideas about that. I'm sure there's truth in what a lot of people are saying, but ultimately, you know, you're dealing with factions in global elites, and I don't think any one of them is morally superior to the other. It's like saying, well, the British Empire was collapsing and in the 20th century, the American Empire was on the rise. It's not like China doesn't want to do these things. It's just that they can't right now. They're in a consolidation period where they're being smart. They are not expending a lot of overhead on military like the U.S. is doing desperately. The U.S. is acting like the world's policeman. They're kind of in, their backs are to the wall, and they're striking out. The Chinese are much more skillfully gathering power around themselves. But I mean, you know, a regime that has been documented to be involved in organ trafficking, that executes several thousand people every year in their military prisons. I mean, it's not like people should fall with the illusion that, well, now China is better than the U.S. They're just a different expression of a global elite. And I don't think it's up to people to ally with some faction in the elites. It's time, as we talked about earlier, for people to take back their own power and not rely on any elite, but reestablish the earth on a common law egalitarian basis. And this is more and more the work we do to try to activate citizens to set up their own common law courts and to take back their own power.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Now, can you give us a little bit of a update on what's going on with the Queen? I mean, are you hearing any uprise within the British royal family as to all the work that's being done by you and many others? I don't want to just say Kevin Annette's the only one doing this, because there is clearly a movement across the world now, which I feel you've spearheaded to really expose these child traffickers and satanic ritualers.
Well, you'll notice if you trace this stuff chronologically, which we try to do in both the books, in both of them, I give a timetable for these events. It's very easy for people to forget how these things happened year by year. But you'll notice that a lot of this stuff has now opened up since our common law court case, where now it's perhaps a bit safer to talk about these things. Elizabeth Windsor is a convicted criminal who's responsible for the death of countless people, but personally, you know, the disappearance of 10 Aboriginal people, children who she abducted. You know, that was one of the bases for her conviction. Well, her and Joseph Ratzinger have disappeared. They're right off the radar screen, which is what you do when you're guilty. You in damage control, you hide the criminal and you put the hand puppet out there for everyone to look at. Well, you'll notice Kate and what's the guy's name? Kate and William. They're being groomed to be the new royal, the kind of with it, groomy, you know, new young royalty in England. And that's who you see now. Just like everyone's looking at Jorge Bergoglio, the smiling guy from Buenos Aires, who's somehow going to save humanity now. Well, I mean, it's the same old BS. You know, it's like distraction. Both of their systems are now convicted criminal organizations. They know, even if most people don't know, they know that they can be arrested at any moment and have their property and assets seized. And so they are doing everything possible to distract and keep people dumbed down to the fact that legally they're being disestablished.
You know, this is a really good conversation, Kevin, because it's very important for all of those that read alternative media, anything, you know, including the Galactic Connection blog or any of the other really cool blogs out there. It's really important for us to not have a all this, all that approach, you know, just to be able to read the information and intuitively extract what we need to from it. because, as you said, ultimately the power is in the people. And until we take our power back, they're going to continue to run the circus. You know, the Bergoglio incident, the fact that you're discussing that they're positioning him in such a way to, you know, regain a more positive acceptance from the people and so on. I mean, they're masters at this stuff. And for those of us who don't think that way, who don't align our hearts that way, it's very difficult, almost painful for us. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, well, it's painful because we've been trained to habitually to think. Most of us don't think consciously. We think habitually, the way we eat. Mm-hmm. And the habitual thinking says you cannot rely on yourself. You always have to have some political or power figure who will bring about these changes on your behalf. You vote and you sign away your authority. You pay taxes and you sign away your resources. At every moment, it's a huge energy transfer of the majority of the small elite. Now, what we're doing is reversing the energy transfer. We're saying, no, we're taking back the power. And even if 5 or 10 people do that, you begin an enormous groundswell. Look what we did. We took our power back and started occupying churches and said, we're not waiting for government or churches to acknowledge anything. We're exposing the graves. We're exposing the evidence. We're performing citizen arrests on these corrupt priests. The minute even a small number consistently do that, the whole system starts shaking. The problem is very few people know or want to do that. Well, that's what we have to start instigating, and you'll see miracles start happening.
And they are. They are beginning. You know, you have to admit, look at how much ground you've accomplished.
Sure. And that's why they put such enormous effort into smearing me over the internet to distract people from the essential lesson. We expose their Achilles heel. We show that you can bring down these institutions and it's just with the truth. And they don't want anyone to learn that lesson, that they have anyone has the power to do that. It's like in nature, in the universe, everything is contained within one particle. The entire universe and its energy is found within one particle. And it's true with any human being. We have the power of the universe behind us if we can mobilize it and activate it. And we show one way to do that. And they don't want people to learn that lesson.
God, that's very well put. In fact, my husband and I were just talking this morning about how this so-called compression of light from below our feet, above our head, it is basically squeezing out all the space. It is densifying the light so that anything that we put to action is really truly going to take flight. It's just a matter of how many of us have the fearlessness, have the commitment, have the dedication, and really have that burning desire within their bellies to assist we the people in all living things. And that's why this is such an important cause to me, because these children are being, you know, taken from, as you've mentioned, not only orphanages without their awares, right? And
right.
All over the world. I mean, this is truly, in my opinion, I mean, to be so hunted as a child across the world, we tend to look at it as, oh yeah, that's just really poor parents selling their children into prostitution because they can't put food on their table. It is so beyond that as you dive.
It is. It's a global industry, and it's, people may not want to look at it, but it can hit anybody. You know, it's, to me, it's a question of not simply recognizing it, but saying, okay, what do we do now? And one of the things I'm doing is meeting with people who want to form workshops to, first of all, learn the common law, and secondly, how to convene courts that can issue these summonses, make these arrests. To do that, you need to, it's part of a much bigger project of how do you get a community to achieve its own. Well, we use elsewhere, there's a term she, which is energy, kind of loosely used, but she means the capacity to exert your own energy, your own identity. Mm-hmm. Identity is a better word to use. when you have an identity that you live vicariously through a thing called the United States, okay, you have lost your she. When you take back your she, you say, no, authority and sovereignty begins with the people, with I and also my community. That's the Founding Fathers' declaration of what America was. Sovereignty didn't come from an authority. It comes from the people, as does the law. So once we act on that, the power shifts.
Good.
There's no authority but God. There is no authority over us but God. That's basic to common law. And God resides within the conscience of each of us. There's no spiritual hierarchy. So, puts everything in a different light and then empowers people to take action. Without that, you can't be empowered.
Wow, that's beautiful. Now tell us a little bit about, God, it's been a long time since you and I've spoken. And back at that time, the Canadian Republic was being launched.
Launched as an idea, launched in a very local way where people made an effort to try to put into practice, kind of floundered on the rocks of people's fear and idea that, well, are we allowed to do this? So it's kind of, the effort is ongoing, but the thing is that I always tend to do this. I tend to overestimate the capacity for people to act. And I think in terms of the idea of the Republic, over half the people in Canada in a recent opinion poll like the idea of a Republic. They don't want any more ties with the monarchy. But for example, there's this group on the Facebook side that wants to establish a Republic by simply taking the Governor General and renaming him as the President. And that would give us a Republic. You just rename the Governor General. I mean, they don't seem to get it, really.
Well, at least it's a step in the right direction, huh, Kevin?
No, actually it isn't. Because
I knew you were going to say that.
It's reinforcing the idea that all you need is some different figurehead and we're fine.
Yeah, well, you know what? The conditioning is so severe and so antiquated and so almost like in our DNA that we must be told what to do and when to do it and how to do it.
Right, and that's the thing we have to uproot. And it's within all of us to do that. It's like the love of our children or the love of nature, or love of God. It's born within us. Our liberty is, and that's the basic precept of common law. And we the people. And it's a matter of taking the next step to actually start doing it, like with any issue, right?
Yes. Yes. Well, and I just want to remind everybody, the two books that he has out now are called Unrelenting Between Sodom and Zion and Murder by Decree, the Crime of Genocide in Canada. Now, the Murder by Decree, is this specifically based on the Mush Hole incident, or is it even far beyond that?
It's much more than that. It has it in there. By the Mush Hole, you mean the dig at the Mohawk Indian
Correct.
School.
Correct.
Which surfaced bones and buttons from children. First time ever done in Canada at an Indian school site. No, it's much bigger, Alexander. It's 20 years of all the research. It contains all the proof of the genocide was deliberate by church and state and that it's ongoing. And it also contains a lot of the evidence censored out by the Canada's so-called Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So, when you gave testimony before the TRC as a Native person, they had to look at it first, and they literally would strike out any reference to a murder, to the name of a perpetrator, to anything that might allow a church or government to be sued. So, this is a serial rapist nominating the judge and the jury and coming up with the obvious verdict of not guilty. That's the TRC report is a total whitewash. This is written as a counter report to the TRC, so it's invaluable. It's also up online at murderbydecree.com.
And I'm going to share something that's a little bit heavy, so I again remind everyone, please stay neutral in this information. And what I mean by that is go with what you know is truth, but don't go into depression because it's not going to stop the situation. It's really action is what we need. We need to really change the way in which we respond to situations and information that we're getting, because we're getting a plethora of exposure of all kinds of crimes and activities that are repulsive. Every day we pick up anything on the internet, and we're there's exposure all over the place of all the disgusting stuff that's been being done behind our backs. So it's very important for us to be able to read this in a state of neutrality, but one of a centered, balanced, you know what am I going to do with this information? I'm going to take action. In whatever way that is, whether it's, you know, spreading the word about Kevin's new book, or starting up one of your own workshops with Kevin, or, you know, pursuing that dream that you've always had to perhaps open up a very safe daycare center, you know, where you provide these children with one-on-one love and kind of out-of-the-box, you know, support. I mean, whatever it is, it's taking action. And I just want to remind people, I read this, Kevin, I just have to share this with people to remind them, for the sake of the 65,000 only in Canada, and that's just an estimate. And it says, the evidence reveals that routine tortures were used on residential children by all of the churches, including the following acts: shaving of heads with dull razors, beatings with brass knuckles, leather straps and pieces of metal, flogging with whips, rape by individuals and organized gangs, confinement in small closets for days without food and water, forcing students to eat regurgitated and rancid food, outright starvation, electric shock to the head, genitals, and gums, forcing students to throw their pet mice into furnaces or beat their pets to death, extracting and filling teeth without painkillers, shoving needles and nails stuck through the tongue, hands, and limbs, forcing students to stand naked in the snow, using manacles in public stocks, confining students for days in the rain and the snow, forcing students to watch others being raped, beaten, tortured, and killed, and forcing them to commit these acts on others and then burying these dead bodies. And I share that with all of you because this is very real. It's not going to go away until we, the people, take the action. I feel that Kevin has a very good system. He should know, considering how much he's paid to get this information out to the world. And I really compel all of you to check out not only his books, but his website at itccs.org. And Kevin, did you want to add anything on to that?
Thank you, Alexandra. Thank you for the courage in saying all that. All of that came from eyewitness testimonies, backed up by two other independent confirmations of their words, plus documentation. So this is not hearsay. This is coming from people who I sat with, who described it. You know, when you're watching somebody tell a traumatic incident, you can see in their eyes that they're not lying. I mean, I know that having worked for many years as a minister with people, you can tell when something is true. And you can also tell it's true by the reaction, what happened when we started publishing this stuff. You know, it's all true. And the question is, when a person with conscience knows that the very government that you're funding and the churches you're funding and attending did these things, you have to view it in a different way. How can someone not continue to go to a church that did these things? That's the question I have. Because I meet these people all the time when we leaflet or protest the churches. They say, oh, well, that was something not connected to me. Well, it's totally connected to you. And why people continue to, they're so numb. Their hearts and minds are so numb that they're not affected by this truth. Part of it was always going to be a mystery to me. But we have an obligation to go beyond that numbness and say, it doesn't matter whether you agree or not, the institutions that did that are by their very nature now disestablished, both legally and morally. They do not have the right to operate anymore because they're criminal bodies. That's just the kind of common bottom line for all of this stuff. So I think that learning these things is like a springboard to action. It can't be just, oh my God, I don't want to look at that, or I feel depressed now. We don't have the luxury of that because children are still dying from these things every day.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And it's just a reminder for all of us. As a girlfriend of mine said a couple days ago to me, she says, listen, no matter how much good news is out there, and no matter how much we are making headway and progress, no matter how much each one of us is doing our bit, we are not out of the woods yet. And we must remain vigilant And remaining vigilant is also to remain aware that certain things are still taking place and to take action. That can even be on an interplane type of reaction. It can be on prayer. It can be all kinds of sorts of things. But the bottom line is, it's just like what Kevin's saying, if we continue to say, you know what, this is really negative information, I don't need to put this into my head. The thing is it already is there in the mass consciousness. We need to stop it. So I don't know, I feel so, I don't even know what it is, but I seem to not only draw Kevin into my life, but others who are very, very passionate about bringing this whole entire operation down. And for me, you know, after seeing the mounds of paperwork that Kevin has sent over to me and seeing it with my own two eyes, these signed affidavits and signed testimonials, I cried. I mean, I literally cried all afternoon going through this paperwork. You know, it's not easy, but at the same time, if we look at it, it's not like, see, a lot of people, Kevin, in the spiritual community, they feel that if we fill our minds with this information, then it's going to lower our vibration. But the fact of the matter is, we are more powerful than that.
Yeah.
You know, we are masters if we choose to be so, if we choose to step into our mastery. And to become a master is very much so to understand the complexity of the darkness on the planet as well as the light.
It's a fear-based reaction to simply run from the darkness and to think we can only exist in the light. That's a bipolar kind of way of thinking. But I find from my own life, for example, that every time I lost something sacred to me, like my children or whatever, I grew from it. I strengthened from it. I was much stronger than I ever realized because I'm a spiritual being. I'm not a we're not physical beings. We're spiritual beings, and we cannot be destroyed by anything. So it's odd that spiritually oriented people would not be aware of that simple fact and dwell from a very worldly idea that, well, too much of this nasty thing is going to somehow taint me. Well, I mean, in fact, the other way around, the more you ignore your own conscience, the more you're diminished spiritually. You cannot exist in a bubble.
Good point.
Good point.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. Well, I just can't thank you enough for all the efforts that you've put out there, and I know you've paid dearly to do this. I just commend you for continuing to work on with it, and I look forward to talking to you about some local workshops here in the Southern California area. I definitely would like to put a call out to all of those that are listening to this interview to please send love and light and protection Kevin's way. Although he is very protected, he can always use some more. And for all of those, okay, there are so many people that have written into me that do a ton of inner plane work right now with this very topic. Okay, there's a lot of folks out there that really do take this to heart. And I'm asking the rest of you, if you aren't already doing that, please consider taking some sort of action now. So again, please visit Kevin's website at itccs.org. Kevin, they can get your books off of Amazon?
It's both Murder by Decree and Unrelenting can be gotten through amazon.com. And murderbydecree.com is also one of the sites where you can find it. Also, just a little plug, there are groups in California, including around Sacramento, that are actively convening common law courts on the whole issue of child trafficking. So if you want to get a hold of me and those groups, you can write to me at hiddenfromhistory1@gmail.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And you guys heard it. So, the other side of this whole thing is the implants, which also are used as mind control devices, are absolutely essential to be removed from the field of the body. And we specialize in that. And we're world renowned for it. So please check out our website at galacticconnection.com. And you'll see the implant removal processes. There's three. It's actually growing. We have a fourth phase that's just been added, which is phenomenal. And we just want to send you love and light, all of you. Thank you for listening to this interview all the way to the end. I know it's not an easy listen, but it is essential. And we will continue to spread the light across this world. Right, Kevin?
Yes, Alexander, absolutely. Thank you. I'll talk to you real soon.
Yeah, you too. You guys take care. Thanks again for listening. Lots of love. Bye-bye.